Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Melina, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Medical Update on Metastatic Lung Cancer. This is a very important call that we're doing today, and we are doing this call in collaboration with many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 742 participants, so there are a lot of you on the call today. This is a very large call. And you come from all over the United States, from different regions and different locales in the United States. And we also have international participants from Africa, Australia, Canada, India, Korea, the Philippines, Turkey, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations, their 800 numbers and website. There's additional resources for you to use. And there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You are the best to be able to tell us what programs we should be offering. It's really your recommendations that really fuel the programs, that really give us the ideas for the programs that we should offer that would be most meaningful to each of you. Indeed, today's program was one that many of you have asked us to offer. So please take that moment at the end of today's program and tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to create those programs. Now, this program was made possible by an educational grant from Genentech Bio-Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Thomas Lynch. Dr. Lynch is Director, Yale Cancer Center, Physician-in-Chief, Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, Richard and Jonathan Sackler, Professor of Internal Medicine. And Dr. Lynch is going to provide an overview of metastatic lung cancer. He's going to talk about the current standard of care, including the role of chemotherapy and new treatment approaches. I now turn the program over to Dr. Lynch.
Carolyn, thank you very much, and thank all of you for spending an hour with us today to talk about lung cancer. So I think the first thing to talk about is, what is metastatic lung cancer? And I think the way I like to think about it first is, what are the different types of lung cancer? Just this morning, I saw a new patient who has metastatic lung cancer, and his family had a number of questions regarding those two points. What is it, and what are the types? So when we think about lung cancer as doctors, we tend to break it down based on what we call the histology. We break it down into small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. Non-small cell lung cancer and small cell can look very similar on x-rays. They have very similar patterns of spread to other parts of the body, but they look different when you look at them under the microscope, and a pathologist can look at the cells under the microscope and tell a non-small cell from a small cell lung cancer. When we talk about metastatic disease, when we're talking about small cell lung cancer, we mean disease that has spread outside of the chest to the point where radiation would not be helpful as part of the treatment. And Dr. Werner Wasik will talk about radiation and the important role it plays in the management of this disease. When we talk about metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, we mean really any spread to any distant organ, be it the other lung, be it the fluid that surrounds the lung, be it the brain, the brain, the liver, the adrenal glands, the bone, the skin, really any other part of the body. So that's the definition of metastatic, meaning it's spread. Now, in general, when something has spread outside of the chest, it becomes a disease that we're not able to cure or get rid of forever. Now, one of the things you'll hear about from Dr. Wakely is the importance of clinical trials that we're performing to try to extend survival and have patients with metastatic lung cancer live as long as they can. And Dr. Wakely and Dr. Warner-Wasik and I have certainly had a number of patients who've lived far longer than anyone could have ever predicted before we started doing molecular testing and using some of these new molecularly targeted therapies. So when I see a patient with metastatic lung cancer, my first question is it small cell or is it non-small cell? And then if it's non-small cell, I like to figure out, is it a kind of cancer that's driven by one of the molecular mechanisms that we have specific therapies for? For example, if it's a patient who has an EGFR mutation or a patient who has an ALK translocation, those two things, EGFR and ALK, those are now treated very differently than traditional metastatic lung cancer would be treated, which usually involves chemotherapy. So for a patient who presents who's got an EGFR mutation, we would then consider a treatment either with an oral drug called, in the United States, it would be erlotinib, but internationally it could be erlotinib or gefitinib, which is a pill that you take once a day and results in an improvement in terms of how patients do. Patients feel better, their breathing's better, with a pretty reasonable side effect profile from the drug gefitinib or erlotinib if you have an EGFR mutation. If you have an ALK translocation, then doctors will work hard to try to find a clinical trial using the drug crizotinib for patients who have an ALK translocation. And that, too, can lead to an improvement in how patients do. It's an oral pill. Our hope is that this drug will be approved by the FDA sometime this year, so it will be available outside of the clinical trial scenario. Now, the first question I get asked by families is, well, how common are EGFR and ALK translocation? Is there a way that you can know that as a patient? And I'd say that if you look at both of them together, EGFR is about 10% of lung cancer. ALK is about 4% of lung cancer. So about 14% of the patients who have non-small cell lung cancer that's metastatic will have either EGFR or ALK. And then the second question, which is important, which is how do you find out? Well, there are some ways that we can predict who might have them. For example, if you're a patient who quit smoking many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, or never smoke cigarettes, you have a slightly higher chance of having an EGFR or an ALK mutation, the ALK translocation. We also know that women have a higher chance of EGFR mutation, as do people of Asian origin. But the best predictor is really smoking status. Now, I get asked a lot, should you be tested for EGFR and ALK even if you smoked? My answer is yes. I believe it's important to know that information, but the odds of finding it are less if the patient happens to have a history of smoking cigarettes. So EGFR, Tarceva or Iressa, ALK, crizotinib, and then the question is, what about the other patients, the patients who don't have EGFR and ALK? In that setting, we believe that chemotherapy is the best approach. And generally, for patients who are fit and have good urinary function and good heart function and good lung function, we would generally start off with two drugs. One drug would be the drug carboplatin or cisplatin, depending upon what part of the country or world you're being treated. And the second drug would either be the drug pemetrexed, otherwise known as Alimta, or the drug gemcitabine, otherwise known as Gemzar, the drug Taxol, the drug paclitaxel, otherwise known as Taxol, or the drug docetaxel, otherwise known as Taxotere. One of those four partners would be used with carboplatin. Which one to use is very much dependent upon what the oncologist who's treating the patient feels is in the best interest of the patient. For example, if it's an adenocarcinoma, one might consider using the drug pemetrexed. If it's a squamous cell cancer, one might use either a taxane like Taxol or a drug called gemcitabine. And those are the decisions the oncologist makes. The outcomes aren't dramatically different from the patient's perspective. We expect chemotherapy to make people live longer and to have better quality of life and less symptoms when they're on treatment. And generally, what we do is we give two cycles of chemotherapy, which chemotherapy is given once every 3 weeks in general, a little bit different depending upon the drugs, but once every 3 weeks. And after two of those sessions, or 6 weeks, we get a CAT scan and compare it to the CAT scan that was done before treatment. If we find that the tumor is shrinking, or staying the same size, we continue with the treatment. If we find the tumor is growing, then the oncologist will sit down with the patient and decide upon what next steps are. In general, about 65 to 70% of patients have either a response or stable disease after those first two cycles. And about 30% of the patients, the tumor will progress, and the doctor will need to use a different agent after the first 6 weeks. At that point, when the cancer begins to grow, the oncologist can then select a number of second-line therapies or third-line therapies. As you're going to hear about from Dr. Wakely, one of the things we think is so critical is the importance of considering clinical trials at every single point along this avenue of treatment. And that's true whether it's small cell or non-small cell, whether it's adenocarcinoma or squamous, or whether you have one of the unique molecular types like EGFR or ALK, because we know overall that the treatments are not getting the kind of results that we optimally want to get, and we're always trying to make the results better. For example, in metastatic disease, we know that the introduction of the drug bevacizumab, or Avastin, is able to cause an increase in the response rate to chemotherapy and a slight prolongation of overall survival. And we wouldn't have learned that if it wasn't for the benefits of a clinical trial. I want to make one comment about small cell lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer makes up about 15% of all the lung cancer that that we see in the United States. Small cell lung cancer, we don't generally do molecular testing beforehand. I know Dr. Warner-Wasik, Dr. Wakely, and I hope that we will find a day where molecular profiling will help in small cell, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. You check for evidence of small cell. When you find that there's small cell lung cancer, there generally are two drugs we tend to use more than any others, which is carboplatin and the drug etoposide, otherwise known as VP16. Now, small cell lung cancer tends to shrink at a higher rate than non-small cell lung cancer. So we see dramatic shrinkages, and a higher percentage of patients will have initial shrinkage. But in the end, the overall survival is about the same whether you have non-small cell lung cancer or whether you have small cell lung cancer. And we know that the overall survival for patients with non-small cell or small cell is a little bit over a year. And we know that chemotherapy makes that survival better by about 20%. It's hard to say what an individual's survival is going to be. And those numbers of a year are not meant to say that any one patient will live a year. No one patient will. It's more to predict what the statistics are for the overall group of patients that are facing this disease. I think it's very important when you meet your oncologist or talk to your oncologist that you ask specifically about your situation and what your prognosis is to allow you to make decisions about what the best treatment for you is and how to balance all of these treatment decisions, which can be very complex and can be very overwhelming. I think one more point I want to make in my last minute is the importance, and you're going to hear from this from Dr. Wakely, of making sure that you report symptoms to your doctors on time, that you get the communication with your care team, which isn't always just an oncologist. Sometimes it could involve a palliative care specialist, sometimes an oncology nurse practitioner, sometimes a physician's assistant, a social worker. All members of the team help contribute to the best optimal care of a patient with non-small cell lung cancer. So, Carolyn, thanks for the opportunity to talk to the group, and I'll turn it back to you at this point.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lynch. Just an exquisite, really excellent presentation and really so comprehensive, encyclopedic, and very understandable. I think you really have a way of making the complex understandable for everybody. So thank you, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Maria Warner-Wasik, and Dr. Warner-Wasik is Professor, Residency Program Director, Department of Radiation Oncology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Dr. Warner-Wasik is going to address the role of radiation oncology and quality of life concerns. And it's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Warner-Wasik. And I have to say that we've included this topic in the programs that we've been doing more recently. It's so important. So I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Warner-Wasik at this point.
Carolyn, thank you very much for giving me a voice to talk about radiation therapy. Radiation therapy is used very commonly in patients who have metastatic lung cancer, the tumor which has spread from the lung to other organs. And what is radiation therapy? In contrast to chemotherapy, where the drugs are given either into the vein or as a pill less commonly, radiation therapy is the use of X-rays or other ionizing radiation, high-energy X-rays directed specifically at the area of concern in the patient's body. And most commonly, radiation therapy is given over an extended period of time on a daily basis. So patient has to come to the clinic between Monday and Friday commonly, and the treatment course may last anywhere from 1 day to 5 days, which will be a week, up to 3 or 4 or 5 weeks in a palliative setting. Palliative setting as an type of radiation therapy or indication for radiation means that we are trying to palliate or improve the patient's symptoms. And patients with lung cancer commonly will be very symptomatic. They may have problems and concerns relating to any organ of the body where the lung cancer has spread to. However, there are several areas in the body which are of most concern and where the tumor goes most commonly. First of all, let's talk about metastatic lung cancer, either small cell or non-small cell, where the tumor in the chest gives the patients problems, and yet we know there is also tumor in other parts of the body. And the very common symptoms of lung cancer will be such as shortness of breath, cough, coughing up blood, we call it hemoptysis, sometimes what we call post-obstructive pneumonia or pneumonia arising behind the obstruction in the airway or compression of the airway caused by the tumor in the chest. And all those can be helped immensely by radiation therapy, either together with chemotherapy or more likely following chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. In particular, for those patients who cough up blood as the result of their lung cancer, which indicates in general that the tumor is close to the airway or invading the airway in one way or the other, radiation therapy is very successful. It is quoted in the literature to control hemoptysis in 80 to 85% of patients. And that improvement is noted fairly early in the second or third week of radiation therapy given to the lung tumor located in the chest. Shortness of breath, which may be caused by the compression of the airway or a large tumor mass occupying a space in the lung or other circumstances, is also helped very commonly by radiation therapy in about one-third of cases, as quoted in the literature. And compression of airways, which is really a mechanical problem, sometimes that's being solved with help of interventional pulmonologists. And the pulmonary doctor will go in with the bronchoscope and try to reopen the airway with using either laser or other mechanical opening techniques. But frequently this is not enough and has to be helped by radiation therapy, or many times such a mechanical intervention is not possible. So what we would do, we would deliver radiation therapy to the chest and try to reopen the airway that way. Sometimes we would use brachytherapy or putting radioactive wires inside the airway, direct them with special image guidance to the area of obstruction and deliver a focused, very local radiation dose to the area of obstruction, or rather incomplete obstruction, to allow reopening of the lung. And that's frequently very rewarding from our standpoint and obviously for the patients, since the symptoms do improve. There is not a clear indication when to intervene with radiation therapy to the chest in case of metastatic lung cancer. The very common approach is to give chemotherapy up front and possibly reserve radiation therapy for the future if the patient has symptoms and if chemotherapy for some reason did not work, there was no response. I guess one exception would be to use radiation therapy up front if the patient is coughing up blood. However, I think there is a trend developing now that for patients who have so-called oligometastatic disease, I have to use this long term, there is a trend to use radiation therapy earlier. So those oligometastatic patients will be those in whom we have, for example, a tumor in the chest, a primary lung tumor, and not too many metastases. For example, one or two or three brain metastases only, and no evidence of cancer elsewhere. And I think that there is a trend to treat such patients more aggressively now. For example, if patient has brain metastasis, treat the brain with whole brain radiation therapy or and or radiosurgery or focused radiation first. And then instead of giving chemotherapy only for the chest disease, many institutions, certainly ours, our institution does it, would be the idea would be to combine chemotherapy and radiation to the thorax at the same time with the idea of maximizing different types of treatment for this patient and certainly improving the local control in the chest. Radiation therapy is used outside the chest in other disease sites, obviously, and very commonly it is used if the tumor from the lung spreads to the brain. As I said, the standard of care is either to use whole brain radiation therapy for 2 or 3 weeks, sometimes following surgical resection of brain tumors if they are large and they are causing problems with compression, or if there is only a single tumor in the brain, the standard of care is to try to resect it if it's in the location which can be taken out by neurosurgeon and follow that whole brain radiotherapy. We know that actually prolongs patient survival. There is controversy whether whole brain radiotherapy or only focused radiation, so-called radiosurgery. Some of you might have heard the term gamma knife should be used up front, and that controversy is not fully resolved. Other sites of disease which are treated by radiation therapy is bone metastasis. Radiation therapy is very effective for pain relief, causing improvement or resolution of pain in 70 to 75% of patients. Specifically, we have now something called intensity modulated radiation therapy given stereotactically when one large dose of radiation is given to the involved vertebra or portion of the spine. And the pain relief may be higher with it. I would encourage you to consider a clinical trial which is trying to compare standard radiation, 2 or 3 weeks, to this large dose of radiation. And also I want to mention that for those patients who may develop lung metastasis in the other lung, for example, they had the original tumor treated on the left and then there's a small nodule on the right side. Obviously, this is something which is treated commonly with chemotherapy, but occasionally we may consider this focused radiation we call stereotactic body radiotherapy, which can be given either with stereotactic linear accelerator or standard linear accelerator or cyber knife. So that's something to keep in mind, that radiation therapy should be considered or may be considered every stage of disease. At least it's worthwhile obtaining a consultation of a radiation oncologist. I'm going to conclude here. I'll be happy to answer questions in the second part of the program.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wernerwasek, for an excellent presentation and very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, just really very comprehensive. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely, and Dr. Wakely is Assistant Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Center. And Dr. Wakely is going to address the importance of clinical trials and how they contribute to your treatment options. She's going to talk about managing side effects and pain, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Wakely.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's wonderful to be on the program. So, yes, I wanted to go into a little bit more detail about some of the topics that have been brought up by Dr. Lynch and Dr. Wernerwasek, talking about really the importance of clinical trials as the first topic. And pretty much everything we know today about how to treat lung cancer, all of the radiation information, all of the chemotherapy information, and all of the new targeted drugs that Dr. Lynch was talking about, all of that information comes from patients who were able to go on clinical trials. And when a patient goes on a clinical trial, they are signing up to get excellent quality standard care. And in addition to that care, they also are going to be treated with either a new drug, a new way of giving a drug, a new technique for giving radiation treatment, some new approach that we hope is going to be better than what we had been doing in the past. Now, if we knew ahead of time something was better and we knew it for sure, we wouldn't have to do a trial. But unfortunately, we don't have any other way of figuring these things out without doing these studies. And so the clinical trials are really, really important. And when I'm meeting with a new patient, and I pretty much only treat patients with lung cancer. I go through with them what are all of the standard treatments, and again emphasizing that all of those standard treatments are built on the knowledge we've gained from clinical trials. And then I also talk about what are some of the things we hope will be better and the ways that we're looking at how those might be better through clinical trials. So we talk about the standard approaches and then the clinical studies. Now, not all patients are going to be a good fit for a clinical trial. There might be something that's unique about their health that makes that not an option, but it's important to as a patient, ask your healthcare provider, is there a clinical trial that's an option for me right now, or is there one that might be an option later? And just to sort of open that discussion. It might turn out that it's not the right thing for you at that time, but at least it gets that out there, and it makes sure that your care providers know that that's something that's important to you. And again, I can't emphasize enough how critical that is, because we wouldn't know how to treat these unique groups of patients, those that have the EGFR mutations that Dr. Lynch talked about, unless patients had gone on the clinical trials looking at that. We wouldn't know that we have new drugs now to treat patients who have these ALK translocations unless patients were going on clinical trials studying those drugs. And as we move into what we think is the future of treating lung cancer, in which we're able to really target the treatment more and have those treatments be more personalized, the only way we're going to get from where we are now to where we'd like to be is by patients going on clinical trials, which will hopefully help not just them, but help future patients who have lung cancer as well. I want to transition from that discussion a little bit now into discussion of managing side effects. Because regardless of treatment, whether it's on a clinical trial, and hopefully less on those than in standard care, but with clinical trials and with standard of care, there are always going to be some symptoms and side effects related to treatment, but there are also going to be symptoms and side effects related to the cancer. And a very important point that I bring up to all of my patients is the fact that when we are offering treatment, we're not just trying to help people live longer, though that's very, very important, of course. We're also trying to help people live better. And in the past, there have been very detailed studies done before we knew how much we could help people with the chemotherapy drugs or with the radiation. We did studies where patients were treated with chemotherapy or given the best supportive treatment we could do. And when we did that and patients got questionnaires where they filled out what is your quality of life, how is your breathing, how is your pain, those sort of questions, it was almost always better to get treatment. So on average, we know that we're helping people feel better with the chemotherapy, which I know can sometimes sound a bit counterintuitive, but we know that with the chemotherapy, with the radiation, we're helping people feel better and hopefully also helping them live longer. Now, the importance of managing the symptoms is also critical. And in a study that was presented last year, and Dr. Lynch was a part of this, we sort of built on that. So now that we had shown how important it is to get treatment to help with symptoms, there was a study where for patients who were getting treated, they focused on adding additional symptom management by bringing in a team of doctors known as palliative care physicians who were focusing on pain management and other symptom management. And in that study, they showed that patients who were getting additional help from that team, being seen at least once a month by a team focused on palliative care, that those patients not only felt better, but actually even lived a little bit longer. So we know that it's really, really critical to pay attention to these symptoms and to make sure that your physician, all of your healthcare team knows if you are having problems. So I emphasize to my patients it's important to let us know if you're having pain, to let us help manage that pain with pain medications, sometimes with radiation if it's bone pain or other areas. Sometimes it means bringing in specialists, but a lot of times it's just focusing on good pain medications. And I hear from my patients regularly that they're afraid of being addicted to pain medications. that they're afraid that if they complain about the pain, that I'm going to be more reluctant to treat them. You know, all sorts of things that are really not true. And so I think it's very, very important to bring these questions that you might have up with your healthcare providers. Patients who are taking pain medications for pain do not get addicted to those drugs. There's really no reason to be afraid of them. Living with pain does not help people live longer. It actually, we think, shortens life because of that additional suffering and stress on the body. And so I just can't emphasize enough how important it is to make pain a priority, pain management a priority, and to really bring that up. No healthcare provider is going to feel that you're complaining if you're talking about pain and working with us to help you feel better. So that's really critical. And the same with other side effects. With newer drugs that we have today, no one should be suffering from vomiting and nausea with their treatments. We're very good at controlling those now. And it's not something that anyone should accept as okay. It's something that should be looked at as a problem and dealt with by increasing medications, working, again, closely with your healthcare team to get that under control. With breathing issues, also bringing in a comprehensive team, including pulmonologists sometimes, to get the breathing symptoms controlled as well. We want to make sure our patients are not suffering as they go through treatment. And again, as we're focusing to help people live longer, we're also really focusing on helping people live better. The last topic I was going to focus on is the importance of communicating with the healthcare team, but I think I've really been emphasizing that throughout my discussion here. It's all about communication. We can help people the best if we know what's going on. I'm always very distressed when I have a patient come in 3 weeks after getting their first treatment and tell me, well, I'm feeling okay now, but the first 10 days were awful. I was sick, and I couldn't get out of bed, and I was vomiting, and I really feel like I've failed to provide the right care for them, because I know if they had called me on day one or two, we could have brought them in, made some adjustments, given some IV fluids, and really helped them feel better. And the same with pain. If someone's having pain and I don't know about it, I know I can't help them the right way. So it's just critical to make sure you ask your care providers, what's the best way to reach you? How do I reach someone after hours? How do I reach someone on the weekends? How can I make sure that if I'm having symptoms, I can let someone know about it right now and get that help right now as opposed to waiting and talking about it a week later? With that, I think I'm going to close to make sure we have enough time for questions. Again, really appreciate the opportunity to speak with everyone on this call.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wakely. Just a very wonderful presentation and very compassionate, and also just being so honest about you're really wanting people to call you right away when they have a symptom, and that all of our speakers have felt that way as well. But you've said that with great eloquence, that people understand that they really do need to call you right away when there is something bothering them and not have to wait. So thank you. Thank you for that. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker before we take questions is Wynn Burkle, and Wynn is an oncology social worker. He's director of social service in Long Island, and he's also our lung cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Wynn is going to talk about the free services that Cancer Care offers, as well as the importance of a support network. And I'm going to turn this program over to my colleague, Wynn.
Thank you, Carolyn. You know, I'm sure most of us remember the time when we moved into our first new home or even our last new home, and I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. Being diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer is, in some ways, very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is or what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heady medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as the first stop for people who find themselves in this new and strange neighborhood of metastatic lung cancer. Using simple-to-understand language in a user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them learn about the basic facts on lung cancer, the different types, how it is detected or screened, the stages, and treatments for lung cancer. And there's a special section on clinical trials, which not only helps one learn what they are all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in a clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a lung cancer clinical trials manager to help them with the whole process of applying and getting involved in a clinical trial. In addition, the website lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Some of the services, such as education, with Cancer Care's many Connect Education workshops, provide both disease-specific information, such as in today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we have distributed over 2.5 million of these very popular publications. And Cancer Care's home website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly e-newsletter, and to services such as support. Cancer Care's professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of metastatic lung cancer, including emotional issues in which the workers are able to assess clients and provide appropriate and helpful interventions. They help with practical issues such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Foundation and other financial assistance resources. Resources for referral to the many organizations and agencies, such as were included in the packet that was sent out, which have been established to help cancer patients. And they're experts at helping one navigate the system, understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in healthcare and the new communication strategies and patterns that are so important in being sure that you have the information and feel confident that you're able to make informed decisions. Certainly, social issues are an area where often come up with the diagnosis of metastatic lung cancer, and dealing with the impact of this cancer among family members, friends, your community, and the workplace. Now, Cancer Care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as individual counseling and face-to-face in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, as well as online and telephone counseling. Support groups, face-to-face again in the New York area, and online and telephone. And I can't understate the amount of support that a support group, in terms of sitting down with a group of fellow lung cancer patients, fellow metastatic lung cancer patients, is we offer so many different types of group modalities for this, and the feedback we get about how important it is to really be with people who are in the same boat, as important as family members are, it's so important to be able to really be with folks who are in there doing that and are in that same situation that you find yourself in. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of metastatic lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Wynn. That's a wonderful presentation in terms of just how people can access the services of Cancer Care and what we can do for them. So thank you so much. And now we do have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Melina to bring all of our speakers on board and also to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please contact Cancer Care at the end of the call, 1-800-813-HOPE. Our staff are here to take your call, so please don't feel that if you didn't get to ask a question, you can call us after the call. Okay, Melina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Allison S.
Hi, I would like to know a little more about with Dr. Lynch and talking about the metastatic outside the chest And does that include the nodes, the lymph nodes, when it's outside the chest?
So it depends. The question really is important because it depends upon if you're talking about small cell or non-small cell. So there can be cases of both where if it's lymph nodes in the central part of the chest, we would not consider that metastatic for most cases of small cell or non-small cell lung cancer because those are areas that we can use radiation therapy for. However, there are some certain circumstances where lymph nodes can be considered metastatic, so it really does depend upon the unique situation of the patient. So I don't want to make a dogmatic statement because it really does depend upon what the individual CAT scan, individual patient look like.
Excellent. And how would they find that information out? They would need to.
I just ask their doctor. Is the best way. Just ask their doctor. Is this metastatic lung cancer or not? What stage is it? Is it stage 4 or is it not stage 4?
Okay. Excellent. All right. Thank you. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Bryna B.
Yes. Hi. I recently heard about a treatment from the Mayo Clinic. They're using MRI laser for cancers localized in one area organ or with limited metastases. What do you know about that? And how can I find out if this treatment is right for me?
Okay. Well, Bryna, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Werner Wasik if you would address that question in a general way, and then we're going to suggest that Bryna go back to your treating healthcare team and, of course, ask those questions. But if there's a general way that you could address that question, Dr. Werner Wasik.
I must say that I'm not fully understanding the nature of the treatment modality which is recommended from that institution. I would imagine that the caller is talking about some type of focused local treatment for small lesions, either in the brain or in the lung. There is a variety of local treatments being used now, including focal radiation, which I talked about, radiofrequency ablation, cryotherapy, and so forth. And it is not clear exactly which type of this local treatment to apply for specific conditions. How can you find out whether whether this is applicable? I believe Mayo Clinic will have a contact number of a person listed under the announcement or a piece of article which you read where you can get more information.
Excellent. And actually, this question raises a very good question. Perhaps all of our speakers want to address this as well, that often people do come across information on the radio, on television, in a newspaper article, on the website somewhere that they find something that looks like it might be new and promising. And I'm wondering if I could ask, I'm going to ask Wynn, first of all, just to address this in terms of just I know many of our people in our support groups raise these questions, want to be informed consumers. And could you comment on just how often we advise people to go about in terms of how they can check out their information?
Yeah, you're right on the mark there, Carolyn. Very often the whole concept or information about new treatments is a very important and large topic in the life of a lung cancer support group. And oftentimes someone will mention hearing something on the radio and cannot document fully exactly where or what was happening. And the group members will say, well, gee, what station was it on? And very often you're able to go to that network's web page and you're able to step back to the health section and find the article that talked about that treatment. That oftentimes serves as a springboard then because if the institution is mentioned, you might then go, for example, in this situation, go to the Mayo Clinic's website and see whether they have reported. And very often it has been a press release from the institution. And oftentimes they will mention the name of the physician and will also say if you want more information, they provide a toll-free number or something like that. I think the resources that we have electronically are such an important contribution to finding information quickly and effectively.
Thank you. And Dr. Lynch, could you comment on that just in terms of, I'm sure many of your patients come to you with things that they've heard, and How do you help people to process what to do with that information?
You know, it's really tough. I really do believe that people need to talk to their individual doctor about it because, mm-hmm. you know, the reasons that certain things make news may be for their scientific interest or their industrial interest in terms of the business of pharmaceuticals and drugs, et cetera. But for the individual patient, you really need to sit down and talk to your doctor. Is this really an advance for me? Is this something I should be taking advantage of? Because you really can't go by just the hype that you'll hear on the in the media, because the media has, you know, they're looking for reasons to make things exciting, and it's not always things that are close to being applicable to patients. So the only one who really can help you with that is your nurse practitioner or your doctor.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Wakely, do you want to add anything as well?
No, I would really echo what Dr. Lynch just said, that obviously in order to make something sound interesting on the news, sometimes some of the finer points are not covered quite as well. And I think that's important to get people interested in hearing about it, but to really then sit down with your healthcare team and say, I heard about this. This is right for me. There's a very useful website that's more geared towards the healthcare providers but is open to patients as well called theclinicaltrials.gov, and that will list a lot of details about most of the ongoing clinical trials, and it'll include information about who may or may not be eligible as sort of a first step, and also where the studies are open. And so I will look at those. I often have patients come in with printouts from that or more specific information about detailed trials, and I'll go through with them as to why this is or is not a potential choice. But it's really, it becomes very individual, as Dr. Lynch was saying.
Excellent. And, you know, there is actually in your materials also, we do give you information about the National Cancer Institute's Cancer Information Service, which is a wonderful resource also. But I think going back to your own physician is most important. But that you can call them at 1-800-4-CANCER, and that information's in your materials. And that can be a wonderful resource as well if you want to check something out that you've heard initially as well. Okay, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sharon S.
Questioning, I had metastasized breast cancer, and it went to both of my lungs. I have several nodules in my lungs. And I was on a chemo pill, Zyloda, and it didn't help. It made the nodules bigger. So now I'm on Doxil, intravenous once-a-month chemo.
And your question?
And my question is, should I get to be radiated in that area? Because mm-hmm. it metastasized into the lungs. Should I ask the doctor about getting radiation in the lungs?
Okay, well, thank you. That's an excellent question, Sharon. I'm going to first ask Dr. Lynch to explain the difference between metastatic lung cancer and lung cancer that spreads to the lung from the breast. If you could just say something about that.
Yeah, this we would not think of this as lung cancer. We always think of the cancer as the cancer where it started. So we would think of this as breast cancer, even though it may be in the lungs at this point. So the things we were talking about earlier really reflect lung cancer itself, not breast cancer that may have spread to the lungs. So I think it still doesn't mean radiation could be of benefit. There are some patients where we do consider radiation who have metastatic breast cancer, if there's a way that we can help make symptoms better. But it's a completely different disease than lung cancer in this respect. So, you know, in terms of what the right next step is, it's really between you and your doctor talking about the different options. Radiation could be used, but it depends upon exactly why you're using it and what your goals are. It depends upon what the CAT scan looks like, et cetera.
Excellent. And Dr. Werner-Wasik, did you want to add anything?
I agree with Dr. Lynch that radiation therapy could be considered, but it is not a solution always for all lung metastasis, meaning tumors which have spread from breast or other tumors to the lung. There has to be a specific number of those, specific size and location, and usually a small number of tumors is when this treatment could be considered. We also would take into account the patient's overall condition and whether they have a disease outside the lung. But having said all that, I think it's worthwhile asking for opinion from a radiation oncologist in the institution which does have focused radiation, SBRT, stereotactic body radiotherapy for lung metastasis.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. And I also, we have a question actually from one of our participants online in terms of just a little bit more, to know a little bit more about pain medication and the concerns about taking pain medicines, and people have sometimes heard that pain medicines can become addictive. So I wonder if Dr. Wakely, if you could address that question.
Sure. That is certainly an idea that many, many people come in with, and we try to stress that that's just not going to happen. If someone is taking the pain medications to treat pain, they don't end up getting addicted. It's true that they need it, that they're not going to be able to stop the medication suddenly, but that's because of the pain needs that they have related to the tumor. There are side effects related to the pain medications as well. Predominantly constipation becomes something we really have to be very aware of, and being tired can be an issue as well. But under-treating the pain has such a negative impact on all aspects of quality of life that it's just really, really critical to focus on that and work very closely with the healthcare team to find a balance and find the right medications. And normally patients are going to be taking some sort of a long-acting pain medication, either a patch or a pill that they take once or twice or three times a day sort of on a schedule, and then have additional pain medication that is going to work when they need something right now. And so most of my patients, most sort of the standard approach is to have at least two narcotic-type pain medications. But then additionally, there are other types of pain medication that can help too, ones that focus more on specific nerve type medications. Also things just like Tylenol can be very, very helpful, or some of the non-steroidal drugs like Aleve and those, but always in discussion with your physician. Even things like Tylenol and medications like Advil and Aleve can sometimes interact with some of the other treatments, and so it's important that your doctor knows all of the things that you're taking for pain management and to really work closely with them, but not to let fear of addiction get in the way of properly managing that pain.
So important. Thank you so much. And our next question, please.
Our next question is from Allison S.
Yes, so I'd like to know, if you do not have the EGFR mutation, will Tarceva do any good?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Lynch, would you address that?
So if you don't have the EGFR mutation, you can get some benefit from Tarceva, but the benefit is not nearly as dramatic as it is for patients who have the EGFR mutation. So I definitely use the drug, even in patients who don't have the mutation, but I tend to use it in different ways. I use it after chemotherapy has stopped working and I need something else, or I use it in different circumstances. So yes, it can work for patients who don't have EGFR mutations, but it's not nearly as profound a benefit as we see for patients with mutations.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've really been an outstanding team of speakers and representing a multidisciplinary team of experts, really, and great compassion as well. Just thank you. And I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked such really helpful questions, really important questions that really allowed our speakers to elaborate further on the issues that you raised. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that 1 hour will not meet all of your needs, that you all have needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so with that in mind, I just want to remind you all that you can access services from Cancer Care, that although the program will end shortly, you can access from Cancer Care services from Cancer Care endlessly. So we have a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services, both individual and group counseling. And we do that on the telephone and online, so we have a lot of people who benefit enormously from participating in support groups. We also have a lot of materials, publications, booklets, and fact sheets, and we also do a number of these type of workshops, about 60 or more per year, so those are available for you to participate as well. But we are really here to really help each of you. And most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with metastatic lung cancer, with coping with cancer. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that you can access services from Cancer Care by calling our 800 number at 1-800 813-HOPE. And please utilize those services. Perhaps most importantly, and when we do these programs, we reach so many of you, we want to be sure that you know that the information on the program today is very helpful to you, but that also you can get additional services from Cancer Care for free. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.